Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering three new Visa credit cards and three new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I have been interested in dreams, studying dreams, using dreams for personal and physical health, probably since I was 3 years old.
This is Kate Noble at the University of Washington's Bothell campus, where she holds the awesome title of Professor of Consciousness. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and what Kate Noble's mind conjures while she's asleep has guided her life since she was a small child.
I can remember when I was three and a half, somewhere around then, having my first lucid dream. I was aware of being in a pretty dysfunctional family. Many layers of conflict, maternal, psychiatric dysfunction, absentee father. But I remember then having this dream, this powerful lucid dream, and encountering this being of light who essentially said to me, this is a rough life. You know, you have put together some difficult circumstances. If you're going to thrive, if you're going to flourish, if you're going to learn what you went to learn, there are some things you're going to need to know. And one of those things is meditation, how to turn in. And I'm going to show you how to do that. And I can't describe it except to say I somehow came back understanding that there were, and this is a poor metaphor, but there were switches that one could switch internally that enabled access to deeper portions of the mind. And that was crucially important in developing resilience and having a larger sense of meaning and purpose, which for many people who go through trauma or dysfunction lose early in life because the pain just doesn't make any sense. And I'm not saying that dreams are a magic cure, but what I am saying is that the dreaming mind can help the waking mind to find comfort and meaning and purpose in circumstances that might otherwise be totally overwhelming. So that's what I learned, and that's what I've been practicing ever since. But I have to remind you, I was a weird kid.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Dream On: Fantasies, Nightmares, and the American Dream Interrupted. That's all ahead on today's show. When Kate Noble starts out teaching her undergraduate class about dreams, she says that for the first few weeks, students are skeptical.
They come in and their primary assumptions are that dreams aren't real, or they don't mean anything, or they're just neurological discharge or stories that we tell ourselves to keep ourselves from being bored when we're asleep. Those are the common misconceptions. So I begin to introduce them immediately to some of the greatest scientific, technological, literary, musical, artistic inventions and discoveries that have all derived from dreams. I mean, when you realize that Dmitri Mendeleev was finally able to create the periodic table and to discern four elements that would not be discovered for another 15 years, all in his dreams, or that Handel finished his masterpiece of the Messiah through his dreams, the students have no clue about that. And when you present that kind of evidence to them, they at least begin to soften the edges of their skepticism. Giuseppe Tartini, who was a violin virtuoso in the 17th century, I believe, and he had a very powerful dream one night where he was sleeping and the devil was sitting on his chest playing his violin, and playing it so profoundly and beautifully that when Tartini woke up, he transcribed as much as he could remember. And it's come down to us as the Devil's Sonata or the Devil's Trill, which is a magnificent piece of work. Tartini also says that it doesn't come close to what he heard in the dream state. One of the things that you see with people, with inventors or the powerful minds that have these powerful dreams, is that they've all been working on these issues for a long time. It's not like they go to sleep and suddenly, you know, they have a profound vision and everything changes in their lives. They've been working for a long time. They get to a point, though, where they give up because they realize that they have reached the end of their intellectual ability to solve a particular problem. It's that giving up and surrendering that seems to be a critical element in the ability to incubate and then discover something in the dream.
So how do you go about studying dreams or dreaming? How do you design an experiment or an observational kind of a setup in order to learn more?
As a psychologist, I'm much more interested in how the taking dreams seriously transforms people's lives. Because I think that dreams, for a lot of people, and particularly students, gives them access to deeper parts of themselves and can answer their questions, can give them guidance, sometimes can enable them to say goodbye to a parent or a loved person who has died. It's profoundly transformative. Students suddenly begin to take the power of their mind seriously. For me, that's significant, because then we can go from there.
Professor Noble says she's speaking from experience. One story she shares with her students is how she ended up living in Washington State.
I tell my students that when I was 21, I hitchhiked across the country. I grew up in Boston area, Boston and New York, and I hitchhiked across the country following a series of dreams. It was a crazy time, but I trusted my dreams and I trusted what they were telling me, and I knew that where I was not where I wanted to be. And literally, my dreams brought me to Seattle, dreams that showed me what the next steps were to be. And then I followed those steps.
Would you actually see places in your dreams and then feel compelled to go there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. My roadmap came through the dream state.
How did you know to trust your dreams like that?
I don't know how to answer that question, except to say, you know how you feel when something feels right, right? Everybody knows that. And that's what you trust. There's an interplay between the dreaming mind and the waking mind, the dream reality and the waking reality. So that becoming more mindful about your everyday waking life and your everyday waking psyche is a critical component of being able to use the information that the dreaming mind is presenting. But they're also a way of helping people develop what I think of as psychological literacy, which is really beginning to understand who they are, what they think, where they come from, what they want. You know, developing a really solid working relationship with their waking mind.
That's Kate Noble, professor of consciousness at the University of Washington, Bothell. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're spending some time in dreamland. We've all had bad dreams, falling or being chased or whatever, but for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, those dreams can take on a whole different character.
Trauma nightmares are almost a videotape re-experiencing of the traumatic event. It's often very vivid, and the awakening, you're sweaty, your heart's racing, it's a real adrenaline storm.
This is Dr. Murray Raskind. He's a psychiatrist at the VA Hospital in Seattle and a professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He got involved in research on PTSD after he started working with a group of African-American Vietnam veterans in 1994.
I'm the only white Jewish leader of a large black veterans ever-expanding support group.
He quickly learned from patients such as a vet named Don that of all the symptoms that tormented these men, the trauma nightmares were among the worst.
For Don, in 1968, during the Tet Offensive, he was a rifleman, but his job was to be the assistant gunner for the machine gun operator, the gunner in his unit. And they were very close friends. And on a nighttime, quote-unquote, search and destroy mission, they walked into a well-placed Viet Cong ambush, and in the confusion, a round from his M16 hit his best friend, the gunner.
He mistakenly fired a round from his own rifle.
That's right. So a round from his own rifle hit his best friend, who died. And this would be replayed in excruciating detail during this trauma nightmare. Even after Don had imbibed a half to a full quart of vodka just to try to get some sleep. And not only was he awakened in an intense adrenaline storm, but he also had tremendous remorse. So Don came to my office, and he was distressed and had fairly intense suicidal ideation. So I said, well, I've got to do something.
Raskin started looking into medications that might be able to help these vets. He found few satisfying answers.
Don was already on the standard medications that are suggested for PTSD, but none of them helped. Alcohol was the thing. And to make it more dramatic, he was the first African-American member of the Iron Workers Union here in Seattle. So his daytime job was climbing up the girders, building these, you know, high-rise buildings with a substantial amount of alcohol on board just to calm down this hyper-arousal.
Raskin homed in on those adrenaline storms, how the vets would wake from their nightmares, sweating buckets, ready to fight or flee. The brain's version of adrenaline is called norepinephrine. Raskin reasoned that if he could tamp down that chemical, maybe he could ease the patient's nightmares. Norepinephrine has two different access points in the brain. There's alpha-1 receptors and beta receptors.
So I said, gee, here's an idea. I'll give Don propranolol to block the beta receptor. So I did. So he comes back 2 weeks later and says, this is a quote, Doc, we're going the wrong direction. My nightmares are even worse. So this was a bit disheartening to me. But I did know from work we'd done in Alzheimer's disease that the beta receptor for norepinephrine and the alpha-1 receptor for norepinephrine often worked in opposite directions. So I thought that if blocking the beta receptor made the nightmares worse, then blocking the alpha-1 receptor may lessen the intensity of the nightmares.
Raskin happened to know of a drug that already did that, a common blood pressure medication called prazosin.
With prazosin, you have to start at a low dose and then work your way up. And I got up to, I think it was 6 milligrams, and went to group. Don gets up in group, walks over, shakes my hand, and said, Doc, it's the first good night's sleep I've had since the NOM.
Raskin's first thought was, well, this must be a placebo effect. He couldn't believe he got such a dramatic response. So he approached another vet in the group, a guy named Scott, whose recurring nightmares replayed a terrifying memory of the North Vietnamese charging the battle line.
Which happened, and one of his jobs, as he was a combat engineer, was to place the Claymore anti-personnel mines in the right position to fight off these attacks. And in his dream, he'd placed the Claymores in the wrong direction. So the MVA came through the wire, and they were in hand-to-hand combat, and then he wake up in a, you know, pouring sweat with his heart racing 120 beats a minute. And he was the second veteran I gave praise to, and he got better as well. And both Don and Scott, he also had suicidal ideation. And once the nightmares disappeared, no more suicidal ideation, and they were able to stop alcohol. So neither one of them has had a drink now for 23 years.
How durable was the response with the nightmares? I mean, did they go away temporarily or what?
As long as they took the prazosin, the nightmares are gone. It's not a cure. It's more like insulin with diabetes. And many veterans say, well, you know, is this real or not? And they stop the prazosin, and the nightmares come back.
What was that like to see that dramatic response?
Well, it was a bit hard to believe. You know, it was, it's probably my personality. It made me feel terrific for maybe 5 minutes, and then I went on to the next problem.
Raskind kept testing the prazosin, conducting early studies with his vets. Word spread about this cheap drug, it's only a few pennies a pill, that seemed to be treating this implacable symptom of PTSD.
So at this point, over the last 3 years, among veterans with a diagnosis of post-traumatic disorder in the VA healthcare system, that's about 700,000 veterans, about 100,000 have been prescribed prazosin.
But they still hadn't done a big, definitive study to cement prazosin as the go-to treatment for trauma nightmares. That was the next obvious step.
We decided to do a big, multi-center trial in the VA. For 6 months, you were 50-50 chance of getting prazosin or placebo. And we were pretty confident that it would work better than placebo, and it turned out it didn't.
The study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, failed to show that prazosin was effective for the hundreds of vets in the trial. Raskind says he was shocked and dejected. So he and his collaborators went back to their successful older studies to find the disconnect. They focused on who was enrolled in the research. The new big study had tight restrictions on who could participate. The people with the worst PTSD symptoms were excluded. So were people with an alcohol addiction. And while the participants all reported having nightmares, many did not have the characteristics of those early cases: jolting awake in the middle of the dream, drenched in sweat, heart racing, unable to get back to sleep. Raskind believes prazosin works. Now it's a matter of finding out what kind of person it works for. If he can do that, Raskind may have a real breakthrough, one that has already turned around the lives of many veterans.
They've been able both to sustain normal family relationships and the ability to enjoy some things in life. Don's gotten very involved in his church, so he's seen as a wise elder rather than someone who was alcohol abusing and irritable and scary and terrified himself. So he'd give an anecdote. He said whenever anybody came over to visit at his house when he was still living in Seattle, before he was on the prazosin, he would leave the back door and go hide in the bushes. They're able to relate to grandchildren. They're both very people-oriented people, now that they're doing well. They would have been dead by now, either by their own hand or by alcohol-induced body degeneration or a vehicular accident.
No doubt in your mind about that.
Yeah, no doubt in my mind about it, and no doubt in their minds about it. So Don says, "Hey, Doc, you saved my life."
Murray Raskind is a researcher and clinician at the VA Puget Sound and the UW School of Medicine. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Dream On. Now we're going to meet a Danish toothmaker who later became a dream therapist at the urging of his Jewish Unitarian minister wife, as one does. Okay, better back up. So for Flemming Barrand, his career as a dental technician was something that he loved.
from a very early age. I loved to paint and to sculpt, and I went to sculpting school and drawing schools and all of that. And so when I found dental technology, because I always really liked detailed work, so I thought, well, this is something for me because it's very artistic, or was very artistic.
So you were actually, you were sculpting teeth.
Yes, sculpting teeth and layering porcelain, putting colors into porcelain and the whole glass technology, which is very artistic work.
He practiced in Germany, in Massachusetts, Washington, D.C. When his wife took a minister job in Utah, he moved his practice there. They eventually ended up in Olympia to be closer to their college-age kids. But over the last 10 or 15 years, the art of handcrafting and staining teeth had transitioned to computers and 3D printers. Fleming began to feel disillusioned with the mechanized version of his industry.
Because I'm interested in life and not in computer life. I want the real life and I want the real art. And it doesn't interest me at all what a computer can do. I think it's wonderful it can do it, but that's not for me.
So when Fleming was weighing his options and trying to figure out what he would do next, he made the most obvious and logical transition.
I've had an interest in dreams since I was a kid.
That's right. Fleming moved from the tooth business to the dream business. More specifically, he studied the theories of psychologist Carl Jung and became what's called an archetypal pattern analyst. Through that lens, he helps clients interpret their dreams.
Archetypes are the things we can recognize in all cultures, at all times, in all places.
So what's an example some people might be familiar with?
Well, the archetypes, for example, is fatherhood, you know, or motherhood. You know, that's an archetype, because we all know what that is about. We know the father is about protecting the family, you know, bringing home the dinosaur, right? And the woman takes care of the child in most cases. Those are archetypal patterns.
And so these are traits or narrative structures that kind of recur throughout time and across cultures?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, how did it occur to you that this could actually be a job?
Well, it didn't occur to me really until my wife told me that she was seeing that I was struggling with this dental technology coming to an end for me, and she had already been through this dream analysis program herself and was actually now using her experience as a minister, and now this new added Jungian psychology, she was using that to become a therapist or a counselor. And so one day she said, well, you know, Fleming, you're a pretty smart guy. You should try and do the same thing, you know, and go the same route as I have and, you know, take the same course at least and get into it.
What did you think about that when she first suggested that?
I first thought that maybe that would be over my head. And it was in the beginning, learning a new language, the psychological language, was difficult for me. But on the other hand, I've always loved reading and studying spiritual stuff. And so I immediately felt very attracted to it and loved it from day one.
So how do you translate that into like a clinical practice where you're actually interacting with somebody?
Well, the way that I work is that my emphasis is on the dream work. So when I have a client, very early on, we start talking about their dreams. And that is, of course, supported by the story of the client, of what they are going through, the problems they have, what they're facing in the everyday life. And then I ask them to start a dream journal. And the dreams are wonderful because they really bring to the surface the images that are actually running the person's life. And so you look at these images and you can really help the patient look at this and see, well, this is maybe, you know, I need to look at these problems that I'm repeating over and over again that doesn't really bring me any, you know, place forward. For example, I just recently had a dream, I will share it with you, where I dreamt that I was receiving all these impressions from a dentist. My whole table was full of these old alginate impressions. And it was telling me that this was a very old way, because that's not how it's done anymore. And so I was dreaming about something, an old way of doing things. And it pushed me to act on it and to say, I need to get rid of all this stuff. that all my dental stuff needs to go because it is an old way of life that I don't need anymore.
So you feel like you recognized from thinking about that dream that you were persisting in something that was not healthy anymore?
Absolutely,
or?
Absolutely. Oh, let's take the archetypal image of somebody dreams that they're walking up the mountain, right? And they are 80 years old. Well, that's not really a place for an 80-year-old to be walking up the mountain. They're actually walking down the mountain because they are on the descent. If we follow the archetypal pattern of old age, that's a time where we need to kind of settle down and go inward and think about life and be of service to others.
Are there some dreams that don't really mean anything?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, because what happens is that as soon as you go to sleep, then the brain just starts its own thing. And some of it is maybe important. Some of it is not so important. And then maybe you have a dream and you wake up from the dream. And what happens is as soon as you open your eyes, the brain starts taking in all these things from your room and your partner, and it pushes the dream in the background. Most people will experience that very quickly. The dreams are gone. And that's because of the work of the brain. The brain doesn't want to hold on to it because it has other things to do as soon as you wake up.
And so does that suggest that if the dream gets pushed back rapidly, that it doesn't persist, that maybe it's got less to do with something relevant?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That may be not that important a dream. If you have what we call an archetypal dream, and it's like you wake up and it's like a movie. You have been in a movie and you see everything. Well, maybe that dream really is important and you need to look at that.
Can I ask you about, you don't have to go to work right now or anything, but can I tell you about a weird dream that always sticks with me?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, I don't have to pay you, do I?
No, you don't have to pay.
So I dreamt that I was an insect, mm-hmm. and I had the point of view of an insect, mm-hmm. and critically, I had like the mental machinery of an insect, because I felt only two things. I felt a drive to eat and a drive to not die, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And when I woke up, I thought, I'll bet that's really what it's like to be a bug.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that has any significance, but I mean, it was a kind of an act of imagination that I don't think I could have conjured up in my waking life. Mm-hmm. So is that a common type of a thing, or does that tell you anything at all?
Well, I would say potentially your dream is very interesting because it talks about a very primitive stage, because an insect is not that sophisticated and they don't write books or have big thoughts. So it's definitely a dream about a very basic state of being, kind of like a beginning place, really, of creation. So your dream tells an image about going back to something very basic. What that is, I can't tell you, because then we would have to be in many more sessions. But that has an archetypal kind of feel to it.
I hadn't put it together in that way. How was it to, like, it's hard to start a new job when you've been doing one thing for a long time and to all of a sudden be an expert in something and then to become a beginner in something. So was that tough for you, or how did that go?
Yes, it is difficult because you will make mistakes when you're a beginner. That's the whole process. It's a learning. That's a long learning curve. And you got to be humble and just say, yes, there's a lot of things I don't know. On the other hand, I'm not under the same pressure as young people are, as in your age, for example, because I already received my Social Security and I'm settled into my life. And so there's not the same pressure as when you're younger. But for me, it's doing something meaningful at the end of my life. I'm doing something that I really love, and it's important to me.
Flemming Berendt is a Jungian dream analyst in Olympia, where he also plays Danish folk music. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We had help this week from Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories and Hans Anderson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We're back next week when our theme is perfection. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.